So when I bail out, I'm gunned up already because I know what we're dealing with. His door punches open. I see his head peek out. I see a hand punch out, and then it's just muzzle flashes. And at this point, I'm at the rear of the vehicle, so it's maybe six-ish feet. So it's pretty much point blank. He fires a couple rounds off. My first round goes off, lands in the kind of the door frame, the A-frame of the rear driver's side door. Stops in there, misses him. He comes down 2 feet. We exchange some more gunfire. I landed 2 rounds on him center mass. I don't know how many he got off on me, but he landed 6.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Shots Fired podcast. We are live here at TAC Ops in New York 2024. We're super excited for this episode because we got the keynote speaker for this event, TJ Webb. We had TJ on early on in our rookie podcasting days. I don't know if you're, I know you remember it, but yeah. I think this one will be much better. You have a wild story to share. And if you guys have not been to a TAC Ops conference, we strongly encourage you to go. Go to tacticalconference.com. There's 3 a year, New York, Nashville, and Washington, D.C.
There's a fourth one now in
Florida. That's right. That's right. We just got hooked up with Florida. So Florida 2025, go to the website. You guys, seriously, one of the best conferences that we've ever been to. The instructors are top notch. The classes that they offer here are phenomenal. And there's offsite training if you want to go to the range and shoot. They do all of it. So you guys are missing out if you don't sign up for one of these conferences. So with that said, let's jump into today's episode and welcome back TJ Webb.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me on here. Long time coming, man. Yeah, I was episode 9, I think, when you started out.
Way back in the day.
It's like 3 years I'm finally meeting you guys in person.
Pre my time.
So yeah, that was we barely, Billy and I barely knew what we were doing. And if I remember correctly, you were outside at your father-in-law's house and the air conditioning kept kicking on.
Yeah.
And I had to try to edit all that out. And so, and it was like post- right after your shooting that you had been involved in.
Yeah, man.
So that was a lot of time had gone by.
No, and that was like the first, interview and podcast or anything like that I'd ever done. So yeah, man, lots changed since then for sure.
So we'll do the TJ Webb episode 2.0.
There you go. I like it.
With the addition of Mark.
1.0.
Okay. Well, with you, yeah,
one
I guess it will be
1.0. Let's split it.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, this is exciting. A lot of new viewers since then. I mean, over tripled in size since. Yeah. So I think for a lot of people watching this will be the first time they've heard your story.
Yeah.
So let's get into it. You are the keynote speaker here at this event with over 1,000 police officers that have signed up to come here. That's a big deal to be able to do that.
Yeah.
You were shot in the line of duty 9 times.
Six.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was tossing you some. We were talking earlier. You said you got shot.
Just the guy that got shot.
Yeah. You got shot in places you didn't even know you were
9 shot. 9 sounds good. I've had 9. I've had 12. You know, it's working up there.
So shot 6 times. That's a lot. Clearly you survived your incident and that's your whole story is capturing what happened and your recovery afterwards and kind of where you are today. And you wrote a book, Just One More, which is awesome. Last time we had talked, I believe you were talking about wanting to write a book or in the process of the beginning stages of it. And so now that's all come to fruition. You've got your book out. That's amazing. We'll get into all that. So let's kick it off and tell us about the night that changed your life completely.
Yeah. December 10th, 2020, man. I was assigned to a fugitive task force with the U.S. Marshal Service. I was with them for a couple of years. And it was any other work day, man. Went to work early in the morning, worked some cases during the day, ended up getting home at a decent time, probably around 5 or 5:30, which was early for me because we usually work pretty long days, and getting dinner ready with the fam. And we get a text message from our team leader talking about an op in the morning, wanting to know who's interested. Fugitive wanted out of Pennsylvania, so it was a neighboring state. He was at a local hotel. That was actually near where I resided at the time. And then the plan was to go out in the morning to this hotel, locate him, and execute an arrest warrant with the Pennsylvania task force officers that were coming down. It was close to me, so I thought, well, you know, the more intel we have, the better. So I got the okay to go out, scout the area real quick, see if I can get eyes on him, get eyes on the vehicle, whatever it may be, just so we can get a little more confirmation on it. So that's what I did. I headed on out. Saw the vehicle, took up a parking spot, called up my supervisor, let him know the vehicle's there, confirmed the tag. And as I'm on the phone with him, suspect walks out. Everything was lining up for intel. He had his girlfriend with him, her two small kids. They got in the car and they left. I let them go because I'm by myself. I'm not going to do anything by myself. Let them go, head back home. Stalled it over. It just wasn't sitting well with me, man. You know, this guy's wanted for attempted homicide. We've now located him. I know where he's at for sure. He's probably out to dinner. One reason I let him go was because I knew he was coming back. He didn't have luggage. He didn't have baggage. He was putting in the car. He was obviously coming back. They're going out to dinner. It's dinner time. So I wasn't really concerned with that. But in the meantime, we're waiting until the morning. This guy could leave in the middle of the night, number one. Number two, who's to say he doesn't get stopped by some random traffic cop for some random violation, and he doesn't know what he's dealing with, right? So talked it over with my team, talked it over with the supervisor. They all agreed, so we ended up going back out within probably about an hour or so. I get back out there before everybody else because, like I said, I'm pretty close to it. Two of my other partners show up, and now we got to sit and come up with a game plan. And we get, there's two options here. One, we have more officers coming from northern end of the state and Maryland, which borders us, which is about 45 minutes. We do a lot of work with those guys. So we got about another 10 guys coming. There's three of us on the scene now. So now it's, if this guy comes back, target comes back, do we let him go into the hotel while we wait for more officers? Or do we take him in the parking lot with the three of us? There's pros and cons of both. We let him go in the hotel, barricaded situation,
hostage,
murder, suicide. Now you're taking rounds through a door in a hotel with rounds spraying in other rooms. You can't fire back because you have innocent people. A lot of problems with waiting, letting him get in that building. The other option is take him in the parking lot with the three of us. You know, I would take the rear. My two partners would take the driver's side, passenger side. Their front was already covered if he parks in their front row where he was before, which he did. So we had him pinned in pretty good. And we had him in the open air. Not a lot of people around. It's about 7:30, 7:45 at night. It's on a Thursday night. It's not crowded. So it's a little better tactically. And sure enough, that's what happened. Guy comes back in the parking lot, does a lap around the building, doing counter surveillance, takes a spot up in the front parking lot or front parking row, same place he left from. So we had already made the decision we were going to do it. I gave the go-ahead. I move in from the rear. My one partner, George, comes in from the passenger side, pins a passenger door. My other partner, Josh, comes in from the driver's side. Wanted to pin the driver's side door, couldn't. There was an unrelated vehicle in the spot next to him, so he couldn't get and pin that door. I came in from the rear, and I came in at a really, really poor angle, which left me tactically vulnerable. So when I came in at this angle off the driver's side rear, it left me at a position where when I opened my door up, I'm pretty much facing his driver's side door. So when I bail out, I'm gunned up already because I know what we're dealing with. His door punches open. I see his head peek out. I see a hand punch out, and then it's just muzzle flashes. And at this point, I'm at the rear of the vehicle, so it's maybe 6-ish feet. So it's pretty much point blank. He fires a couple rounds off. My first round goes off, lands in the kind of the door frame, the A-frame of the rear driver's side door. Stops in there, misses him. He comes down 2 feet. We exchange some more gunfire. I landed 2 rounds on him center mass. I don't know how many he got off on me, but he landed 6. Left shoulder, left hand, 2 on the right arm, the right femur, and then I took a ricochet from my body armor to my chin. So needless to say, with the femur shot, that dropped me right at the back quarter panel of the car. Lost my gun. It kind of fell out of my hands, rolled underneath the back of his car underneath where he couldn't see it, but I could see it. Now I'm on the ground. I can see my gun, but I can't grab it because both my hands are broke. One's got a bullet through it, and the other one's broke because I landed on it with my plate carrier. Nothing works. So now I'm on the ground. Can't see anything. I'm hearing gunfire going off still. I don't know if I'm being shot at. I don't know if gunfire is being directed at my partners, if they're firing back. It just sounds like chaos, right? And as I'm on the ground, man, there's lots of things going through my mind at that moment. You know, the obvious, life and death. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I'm thinking of my family, man. I'm thinking of my wife, thinking of my son, my parents, my friends. I mean, all that in a matter of seconds is just racing through your head. And while I'm on the ground, there's this voice pumping away in the back of my head, just tap, 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 and just tapping away, man. And it's screaming at me. And it's saying, you failed. You failed. You failed your family, and now they're going to pay for it. And that voice, man, it went on to haunt me for a long time. But in a strange way, it was that same voice and those same words that played a big part in saving my life. Because it was that voice and those words that got my ass moving. And as I stared underneath the suspect's vehicle, it was just black. And then all of a sudden, I could see my wife and I could see my son. And they were just there smiling and waving at me like, come on, like, come home. And it was that moment I realized, like, I'm not out of this fight, you know? Like, I don't have my weapon. I can't run away. I can't use my hands for anything, but I got two elbows and I got one good leg. And I got to get moving. I can't lay here and die because he's got to take 2-3 steps and he's going to finish me. So I just did everything I could and I crawled and I crawled and I shoved myself underneath the rear of his vehicle and tried just to protect as many vital parts as I could. And my hope was if he does come back and try to finish me, he just pumps my legs up and hopefully I don't bleed out. But in the course of that, George was able to engage him from the passenger side of the vehicle. He threw around through the front windows, the front door windows, not their windshield, but the doors. Through the glass, through both planes, ended up striking him in the side. He took off running and actually ran by me as I was underneath the car through the parking lot. Ended up engaging my other partner, Josh. Josh and George did a phenomenal job. If you hear them speak about it, it's really good to see how they were both thinking alike in that situation without actually communicating. The first thing they said was when he ran by, it kind of caused like a crossfire situation with the two of them. And the first thing they both said was, the first thing that popped in their mind was like being at the range, you know, dress the line, stay on line when you're moving, right? And that's what they did. They dressed the line on themselves without even talking about it, moved forward, pushed towards the threat, and ended up taking care of the threat about 75 yards into the parking lot until he went down. The two of them kept in communication real quick. And it was just like training, man. Josh looked at George and said, you good? George was like, yeah, I'm good. George knew, like, I'm staying with the suspect until help arrives. Josh came back to me, pulled me out, strapped on a tourniquet, threw me in the back of his car. And now we're off to the hospital, which is about 8 minutes. I was still with it. I was conscious, alert, breathing. I was good. Obviously, I'm in shock a little bit still because I have all this going on, you know. Josh was in shock too, and it's just natural. But we're communicating. I'm in the back of the car. We're communicating. And everything went as planned as far as pre-op, you know, in the ops plan. Like, you know, Josh was a designated medical vehicle, and he ended up being that. We always have the nearest hospital programmed on our GPS and our phones, ready to go. He had that. Phone's on the dash. He hits go, comes out of the parking lot, phone falls off the dash, rolls underneath the seat. He doesn't know where he's going, right? Oh, luckily, I'm in the area. I'm local to that area at that time, and I was awake. So as we started down the highway, I could see out the back windows, like through the looking up, and I started noticing billboards for like restaurants and stores and whatnot. And I knew we were going the wrong direction, so communicate with him. Which way are you going? I'm heading south. We got to go north.
Oh, so he's going the wrong way.
Going the wrong way. It wasn't too far. We made about 2 traffic lights, so it wasn't like, you know, super far out of the way or anything. He corrected course, made a U-turn, headed back northbound, and then he's on the radio communicating, getting directions with dispatch, trying to get some state police units that work the highway out there to kind of meet him, to guide him in a little better than I can explain from laying on my back. But we kept in communication, and the whole time I'm on the back, the back seat, it was, I had the same process mentally as I did when I was lying on the ground. And it was, you have to look for work. You can't just lie there and accept it for what it is. You have to keep busy. You have to keep looking for work. You have to stay in the fight. So I started going through a checklist with myself. First, I had to assess the situation, meaning I had to really like stop for a second, gather myself and realize what was happening. I've been shot multiple times. I'm on my way to the hospital. I really had to process that. And then the next step was I need to fix whatever I can fix, which at this point wasn't much because both my hands are inoperable. They're just out of commission. So I can't fix my tourniquet. I can't take my vest off. I can't check for other wounds. I'm pretty much screwed with that. But there's one thing I can do. I know I'm losing a lot of blood from my leg. My leg's swollen up huge to the point where my pants are starting to rip. It's swelled up so bad. I know my legs, the bone's not attached because it's just, when I was on the ground, my leg was at a 90 degree angle. I could high five my foot if I wanted to. Ugh, wow. And as I was crawling, I could see the foot getting further and further away from me as it was like dragging behind me. So I knew it was in bad shape. So with the blood loss was my major concern at that point. It was the only thing I could work on. So I started working on combat breathing. And this is where, you know, you can read about my book as I get into it, but physical fitness in this line of work, man, it's key. It's paramount. And to jump ahead real quick, you know, that's the only thing the doctors and I agreed upon was I would not have had the recovery that I had if it weren't for the condition my body was in going into this shooting. But I started working on my breathing, slow breaths in, slow breaths out, gathering myself, got that under control. Kept in communication with Josh in the front seat, but I had to keep thinking. I had to keep skipping ahead and thinking of the next step, next step, next step. So I knew we were going to get to the hospital, so I had to start thinking, like, what's going to happen next? We're going to get to the hospital. They're going to take my gear off. They're going to knock me out. They're not going to keep me awake in the condition I'm in. There's just no way, right? And that's what happened. We got there. They knocked me out, but I had to think ahead of that too. And I didn't want any surprises. If I got a surprise, I wanted it to be a good surprise. So I had already convinced myself in that ride to the hospital that that leg was gone. It was so far damaged. It's gone. I'll be a paraplegic. And you know what? It's cool. I accept it. People do it every day. They have great lives. I'll be no different. And I was ready for that. I wanted to wake up in the hospital. And if that was the case, be like, all right, yeah, I expected that, you know, or I was going to be happily surprised that it was still there. And it was still there, thankfully. But, get to the hospital, go through all that. They knocked me out. And then during that time period there, I was at, that's the first hospital stop. I was there for about an hour. And during that time period comes the notification, family notification. And like I said, at the time I lived, my wife and I lived with my in-laws because we were in between homes, which worked out good. So Delaware, you know, where I work at, where I live at, is a small state. And it's an even smaller law enforcement community, as you can imagine. So when something like that happens, word of mouth is quick. You know, other cops find out, spouses find out, social media finds out. It travels quick. My wife started getting word probably easily within 20 minutes of the shooting through text messages of friends. Hey, are you okay? Do you need anything? She didn't know what they were talking about. And then finally she gets a phone call. She's in bed with my son reading him a story. He was 7 years old at the time. And she finally gets a phone call from a friend whose husband's a cop near us. Wanting to know what she needs and everything. And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about, but you need to tell me right now. And her friend ends up, ends up telling her, that I'd been shot and I was in the hospital.
So she found out 20 minutes after?
Give or take, yeah, about 20 minutes. Before my agency could get to her, yeah.
But all these other people I'd already heard.
Already she's heard, basically yeah. I mean, it was on Facebook and stuff that fast, yeah, within minutes, yeah.
So was there any representative from the PD reached out to her?
They did. She had just gotten to the hospital, I believe. She was on her way there, but we only lived about 10-15 minutes from the hospital. It wasn't far. So she found out on the way there when she had just gotten there, but she had already knew. One of the sergeants had called her, and you know, it was It just took a long time, and I don't fault them. Our agency hadn't had an officer shot in a line of duty like that before. The process took a lot longer than it should have, for sure. But I know it was something that was hadn't happened at our agency, and they probably just weren't prepared for it. Didn't know how to handle it, which is, you know, I'm not gonna get mad about it because there's nothing I can do about it, right? So she found out when she got there. Or she got the call while she got there. And then when I got transported to the next hospital, they flew me. But my agency drove her up. And my son stayed back at home with my in-laws. But my wife got to the hospital with my father-in-law. He ended up driving her over there, so she didn't have to drive. Dropped her off. When he went back home with his wife and my son, watched take care of my son.
I was going to angle that a little bit towards you there.
Family notification, man. I will say, and the reason I said earlier, like staying with my in-laws was a saving grace, is because this is something I talk about in my course I give, is we got to have a plan. I didn't have a plan for my family if something were to happen to me. You know, like, what are you going to do if you're on the job and something happens to you and you have a spouse at home with kids? What are they going to do? Who are they going to call? You don't want your kids coming to the hospital. You know, yeah. You don't want them being around that. You got to have, is there a neighbor you can trust, a close friend or family member that's nearby? And if you do, you need to have a conversation with them. And you need to say, hey, this is the reality of the world I live in. And if things go south, can I count on you to be there when I need you? Mm-hmm. I didn't have that, but, you know, who thinks about that? I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, at this point, I had 17 years on the job. I didn't think about that, man, you know? It was a job. I went and did the job, you know? But having a plan, something to think about, having a plan, man, for your family, it's important. And like I said, that was our saving grace that night. So from there, that night I get flown north, about an hour north or so, to a better hospital, get checked in there. I'm out cold at this point. This is a Thursday night. They got me intubated, flew me north, got me in there. My wife was drawn up by my PD. She was given a hotel room that night. And next day, I'm still out. Had surgery around 2 o'clock, give or take, in the afternoon. Ended up having a rod in my femur, some plates and pins in my hands. Had some shrapnel dug at me. Still have some shrapnel in me now. But and then later that evening, I started to come around a little bit. From surgery, don't remember too much. I saw some glimpses of my wife, my parents, and that was pretty much it. And this is December of 2020, so COVID is a problem at this point.
Wow.
So I wasn't allowed to have hospital visitors. My wife wasn't allowed to see me after that. I was there for 7 days in that ICU. I couldn't see my family. The saving grace that I had there, because it was deemed a security issue for me, was I had one representative from my agency with me 24 hours a day and one representative from the Marshal Service with me 24 hours a day. So I was never by myself, which was great, man, because I wasn't, you know, it was hard to sit there through all that day in and day out for 7 days by yourself. I can only imagine. So I'm there for 7 days and, you know, I'm trying to talk to the nurses and doctors and see like how bad this really is. And, you know, the answer I keep getting is this is like a 2-year recovery. You're probably looking at, you know, 18 months until you can run again. Your hands are a big question mark. They're pretty bad. We don't know, like, what usage you're going to get out of, like, what fingers. it's pretty bad. So day 7 comes. My wife comes up, sees me, finally. I get to see my son because they're going to transport me to a live-in rehab facility. I got to go there for a couple weeks. So I get transported by ambulance. I was able to ride in the ambulance with my son and my wife, which is great. Because as you can imagine, when I first saw my son, I was on a hospital bed. I got bandages all over me. Excuse me. I looked a sight. Of course, I'm crying like a baby. He's never seen this before. So he's 7 years old. He's in shock. He doesn't know what's going on. He's kind of a ghost faced, you know? So I got to ride in the ambulance with him, which was good because we got to, you know, loosen up a little bit, tell some jokes, get him smiling, let him know, you know, dad's okay. We get down to the rehab facility that night. It was a Thursday night. And take me up to the room, check me in on the second floor. A few staff members there to welcome me, my wife. And the one thing I had going for me there was I couldn't have visitors, but they were going to make an exception and allow my wife up every day for visiting hours, which was great because no one else was allowed to have visitors in the place. They were making an exception for me. So I was very, very thankful for that.
Was that because of COVID?
Yeah, COVID. They actually had a COVID outbreak while I was in there. So it was train wreck. but they stuck to their word, man. They let my wife keep coming up every day. But that night was the first night that I was alone for 7 days. This is the first real opportunity I've had to sit and process what had actually happened to me. Because the whole time I was in the hospital, I was either taking quick cat naps or I was in conversation, you know? So that night was a long night. I laid there. I didn't sleep a wink. Just thought about everything. Like, you know, where is everybody? Like, how bad is this? Everything. And then the worst was, you know, am I going to be a burden? Like, I'm pretty messed up. Am I going to be a burden to my family, to my wife, to my son? Am I going to be able to play ball with my son? Am I going to be able to go for a run on Sunday morning with my wife like we always like to do? Like, are those days done? No, man, they can't be, you know? That was my life. I didn't want to give that stuff up. You know, my mindset started to turn to, you know, I didn't lose in that parking lot. And I wasn't going to lose in my own home in all my days going forward. It just wasn't an option. So I didn't sleep at all that night. And then 6 a.m. comes, pitch black in my room. 6 a.m. comes, door swings in with a nurse coming in the morning to check on me. And this bright light comes shining in from the hallway on the door. And it made me think back to a book that I read about 5 or 6 years earlier called The Trident by Jason Redman. And I won't get into Jason's story, but he was a SEAL who was severely injured and wrote a book about his time in Walter Reed and his recovery and how during his time in Walter Reed, he made a sign to put on his door for a number of reasons, but we'll just say motivational purposes. And I remember that for some reason. It stuck in my brain when that door opened up, and I thought, man, that's a really good idea. Like, I need to do whatever I can to get something moving here. So my wife came up that morning for visiting hours. We started at 8, and I said, hey, I need a marker and some poster board because I want to make a sign. And she wanted to write it out for me because I was going to make, I wanted my own words on there, but I wanted it in my own handwriting, you know, which my hands didn't work. They were wrapped up in boxing gloves. So she stuck a marker in there in my cast the best she could, and I just kind of shaped it out the best I could. And I put this sign up on my door, stuck my patch on there and signed it the best I could. And I put this sign up there for two reasons. One, for what it said. I didn't want a pity party in my room. I didn't want nurses coming to my room with sad faces saying, poor me, this poor guy, and just feeling sorry for me. I didn't want that stuff, man. You know, I wanted a happy atmosphere. I wanted people to come in with a smile on their face. I didn't want it to be some pity party. You know, I started every morning with music playing on my phone. I called shift change every morning to check in with the guys, see how the night work went, what kind of complaints they had, kept in contact. And the other reason I put that sign up there was for me. It was for accountability. Because I knew every morning I started my day, if I didn't live that day by the words that I had personally put on that sign, I was a hypocrite. And to me, that was the worst thing I could be, was a hypocrite. And it worked. You know, it kept me moving, kept me motivated, and it, in a weird way, man, I'm in this home, man. It was like motivating the elderly people that were in there to get moving, man. Like, the therapist would come to me and be like, man, I don't know what you're doing, but these people in here are like 80 years old, man. They're putting in the work.
Cracking the whip on the old folks.
It was cool, man. And in a weird way, you know, for as much physical and mental pain that I went through in that place, I made it what it was, man. I had a good time. I met great people in there who really helped me out and did some great things. And I cherished my time there. I was appreciative of it because, you know, it could have been a lot worse, you know? So I did my time there, and I had to come up with a game plan. So I made a list of goals, and I had long-term goals. The nearest one being I wanted to walk out of that place in 2 weeks, and I wanted to walk out under my own power. I didn't want a wheelchair, a walker, a cane, crutches. I didn't want any of that stuff. I wanted to walk out on my own 2 feet. I wanted to do the work that I could get out of there without assistance. And then the furthest one was I wanted to run a half marathon in under the 1 year mark. They were giving me 18 months before I could start running. I wanted to do a half marathon in under 12. So day comes to leave, and they came out the room to bring me out to leave. And of course they brought up a wheelchair. I didn't want it. They brought up a walker. I didn't want it. So we had a 5 or 10 minute conversation on how I was leaving that place. And it pretty much came down to, I'll stay here another week, a month, a year. I'm not leaving. Well, that's, I'm walking out of here on my own. And they were receptive to it. You know, they did it. So I walked out on my own, under my own power, with someone trailing behind with a wheelchair just in case. But no one touched me. And that was my first short-term goal that I had knocked off, man. And I kept it going from there. I started my outpatient recovery the very next day, 5 days a week, doing stuff at home. And before you know it, after 4 months, I started to run outside on my own. I started out with a half block, ended up being, you know, a half mile, a mile, 3 miles. And then by June, I'm running like 6 miles. November rolls around. I had already signed up. When I got home from the hospital, I actually jumped ahead and signed up for a half marathon. I was like, there's the next half marathon close to me is in November, and I'm doing it. And I signed up, and I had it on my calendar. I was like, it's going to happen. And November comes. I go run the half marathon. And like I said, I was into fitness before this. I ended up running the fastest half marathon I ever ran in my life, man.
Really?
8 minute miles.
Wow.
Fastest half marathon I ever ran. And I remember crossing the finish line. Well, I remember the last mile. The whole last mile, man. I saw the mile marker for the 13 coming. And I just started crying. And then, and I got pissed off because the crying was slowing me down. And I was like, this is going to ruin my time. I got a pretty good time going right now, you know?
Yeah.
Crossed the finish line, and I remember collapsing on the boardwalk. I have a photo of it in my presentation that I'm for here at Tac Ops. And two reasons. One, I was in a little bit of pain.
Yeah,
bad. You know, that my leg was hurting a little bit. But the other was, man, emotionally, I was experiencing some things that I had never experienced. I mean, it was every single emotion you can imagine, man, like happiness, sadness, anger, fear, frustration, hate. I mean, everything was just erupting at one time. And it was the strangest feeling, but it was like the most amazing feeling at the same time. And I thought, man, there's no way I could ever get that feeling back, but I wanted to. So 2 weeks later, I ran another one.
Oh, and savage. And you are a running savage. I'll give you that.
And I ran that one slightly faster, so I had another personal best. Not the same feeling, but still felt great. And from there, man, I kept it going with the fitness. I still do. And I did the David Goggins challenge, which is 4 miles every 4 hours for 48 hours, which is 48 miles. Wow. I did that. In March, so that was like, you know, 13 months or something. And then I did a half Ironman in June at the 18 months where they said you might be able to start running in 18 months. I'd done a half Ironman, so 70 miles. I just kept it going, man. I didn't want to get my life back. I wanted my life to be better than it ever was. You know, I wanted this, what happened to me, to be something good. You know, sometimes good things come out of bad things, right?
Oh, for sure.
And the way I always look at the shooting for me is, people always ask, well, what would you go back and change? Well, I wouldn't change anything, because you can't think of it that way. It happened, you know what I mean? And this is what I've gotten out of it, and I've gotten this out of it because I set the road for that, you know what I mean? I chose to take a different path than what was laid out in front of me. And that's the message I like to spread to people, man, is like, you got to make it happen, man. You can't sit back and not do anything. You have to look for work. You know, I looked for work in the parking lot, looked for work in the back seat, and I kept looking for work going forward with rehab and everything else in front of me. And you just have to win, you know? And it wasn't just for me. It's for my family. Like I said, I wanted to raise my son and teach him how to play ball and go on the runs with my wife and go to the gym with my wife and do everything that I was doing before. And I wanted to do it even better. And I do. I'm the happiest I've ever been in my life. I'm the most successful I've ever been in my life. My marriage is fantastic. My relationship with my son is fantastic. And for what it was, like, something really good came out of it. So in a weird way, am I happy that happened to me? No, but I'm thankful for what I've gotten out of that experience, you know? And I think that's the way that we need to look at whatever critical incident or setback you go through in life. Like, you got to make it work for you, you know?
Yeah. That's a powerful message.
Yeah. But, yeah, man, quite the experience.
That's a wild story. This is the first time I've heard it. I'm sitting across from you, and this is, I haven't even been able to say anything this whole time because it's
Well, so amazing. So really small world. Yeah. When we were flying here, when we landed here in Syracuse before getting to TAC Ops, we're sitting there in the baggage claim terminal and waiting for our luggage. Yeah. And I happen to just turn around and I look and I'm like, holy crap, that's Jason Redman.
That's so awesome, man.
And so it was just like, crazy to me because here we were coming here.
Yeah.
You were coming here to be the keynote speaker about this incident. I know that he played a huge part of your recovery. You wrote the note like he wrote on his door.
Yeah.
And then we turn around and the guy is literally standing right next to us.
Yeah, man.
His bags. I was awesome, like,
dude, man.
I know I texted you and told
it's
you.
It's wild. Like when I put that sign up on my door, I looked him up on Instagram. I wasn't big on social media. I found him on Instagram, followed him, and then sent him a message like, hey, man, this is who I am. This is what happened. I hope you don't mind. I stole your sign idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we kept in contact, man. And, you know, I talked to him quite a bit for a while there, and he helped me out with some advice and stuff. And he ended up doing me a solid and put a forward in my book for me, too. Like, he's just a stand-up, dude, man. And I got a lot of respect for that guy and what he does to give back to military and first responders. Just a stand-up dude, man. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I just thought that was...
That was really cool.
That was just odd to me.
That's cool. Yeah.
So
none of that nothing connected for me because I've not heard the story, but now looking back, it's like, that's
even more kind of ironic.
Yeah.
It was a cool trip for sure.
That's neat.
So real quick, going back to the night that you were shot, one thing that like really stands out to me that I really hope resonates with cops listening to this, especially if you're in an assignment where you actively go out and look for people, it was the pre-planning thing and the fact that every time you guys went out and did this, 9 out of 10 times, right? These things always go your way, but you still put in the GPS in your phone. Like you still had all of these things in line, even with only 3 of you.
Right.
You know, that's a big deal, man.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people skip steps. I think
you got to have your checklist, man.
Yeah. Cause they're like, hey, we'll just go swoop this guy up real quick and be done with it and go home for the night. Right. Like we shared a story in our class that we teach here about that. And it bit somebody in the butt and they were also shot. So I think it's just really circling back to having your ducks in a row, get your plan together and don't deviate from your plan.
Right.
Do it every single time.
Yeah.
Because the one time it doesn't work out for you, you don't know when that's going to be.
Yeah.
And you really want to make sure that you don't skip out on that kind of stuff.
Yeah, man. So complacency kills.
I know the guy's phone slid across the ended up taking you a couple miles, you know, stoplights down the wrong direction. But the point is you guys were prepared and you didn't skip those steps. And so,
yeah, it's important, man. Your pre-planning is crucial, man. Like if he had pulled back in that park lot before we were done talking about it, we would have waited because you have to be ready. Right.
Yeah.
If we weren't ready to make the decision, then we would have waited till our boss got there and made it as a bigger team. But we were ready. We had everything lined up, knew what we were going to do in both situations, and that's the one that played out, and that's the one we stuck with. We rolled with it, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, you know, ideally, do you want to do a vehicle takeoff with 3 people? No.
No.
But we had done it, and when you outweigh risk and reward, so to speak, in certain things, that was, for us, we felt like that was the best way to handle it, you know?
Yeah. I think it circles back to, like, what we talk about is being flexible and making a decision.
Yeah.
Like, being able to critically think, make a decision and then be flexible with that decision. And like you guys were weighing out pros and cons to all of that.
Right.
But you stuck with a decision and you executed it.
Yeah.
You know, granted that was the turnout of it, but you know, that could have been way worse had he gone back in that room.
Right.
You know,
I mean, that was going to based off of what we had, what happened. Now, if we went to the room, it was going to be a shooting.
Oh, for sure.
So now he's got, there's three people in there, and then he's got other rooms. We wouldn't be able to fire it back. It'd been way worse, you know? Mm-hmm. So
I really like that too. It's the critical thinking, decision making, and then being able to be flexible with your decision. And then once you've made that decision, it's like, all right, this is what we're doing.
Right. There's make no a plan, stalling. Stick to it. Don't deviate from your plan. Stick to it. You know, things happen, you know, things fall off the wheel sometime, but that's every tactical situation, you know, and you just got to adapt and overcome it. You know,
I think a lot of cops get paralysis by analysis or analysis by paralysis, where it's like you're overthinking something for way too long.
Right.
And then, you know, your opportunity either passes or, you know, mistakes get made because you're just thinking about it too much.
Make a decision and go with it.
Yeah.
Nice. So. Well, what's tell us about this book? Hold this thing up.
So yeah, man, just one more. It's my new book. Came out November of 2023.
Hold up to the camera there.
Right there you go. Just one more. So yeah, it will detail the shooting. It will also go over some other things earlier in my career that I handled, some other critical incidences. Some of them I handled pretty good and some of them I handled pretty poorly, and I could have handled them a lot better. And it's just a book of overcoming, you know, setbacks in your life. And it's a great cop. It's a great book for cops, obviously. There's a lot of cop stuff in it, but it's a book for anyone because you can really learn tips and tricks that I use to get through the hard times. Not just like a shooting. It'd be a car accident, falling off a ladder and breaking a leg, whatever it may be. But it's also for the average person, it's a good look into the typical things that a first responder or cop goes through in their career. And I think that's one of my favorite parts about it is that anybody can pick this up and get those two things out of it. Something that can help you through a critical incident and give you a little more insight on what we deal with throughout your average 20-year career. You know what I mean? That's one of my favorite parts about it.
How does somebody buy this?
So you can find it at thetjweb.com. You can go to my website there, pick up a copy. Right now it's the only spot you can get it at. We're going to expand on that here in the near future. But you can pick it up there.
All right. So
thetjweb.com. TJWeb.com.
Yeah, we'll put all the links and stuff in the description in the show notes if you're listening to it on audio.
What's your social media?
Yeah, social media and how do people
get all you? @thetjweb, Instagram. I'm on Facebook, but you'll catch most of my stuff on Instagram. You can find me on LinkedIn too.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, you have a special guest here with you. Your wife.
Well, it's not his guest.
My wife and
it's our guest.
Well, I know. I wasn't going to break the ice, man. So your wife is here with you to support you through your keynote speaking and hang out with you. So we were actually going to ask her to pop on real quick and share her side of the story of being notified and going through all of your adversity being the wife.
Love it.
Yeah.
Amanda, so can you come over here?
Switch out. You're up.
Oh, goodness.
All right. You're in the hot seat. First question. Have you ever been on a podcast?
No,
this is your first. Awesome. So we're your first. That's good. So we're not going to take too much of your time. I know everyone's got a lot going on here, at the TAC Ops, but, we want to know from your perspective, when you got notified, we were chatting about this earlier, getting late notified by the department, finding out through, you know, third party, your friends that TJ had been shot. Can you just walk us through that and then give a message out there to anybody listening or watching this, how things could have done or been done a little bit better or how they can plan for something like that?
Sure. Well, you know, like TJ said, we were, we sold our house and we were building a house. So we were in between and living with my parents. So I was at home. It was a Thursday night, school night, putting my son to bed. He was 7. We were reading a book. And my phone starts just like buzzing, like Facebook messages, text messages. And I remember I got a message from like in a group that I'm part of and they're like, oh, Amanda, I hope everybody's okay. And I was like, you know what? It's a great group of guys. I'm not worried about it. Like I felt safer with him with those group of guys than him out on patrol, right? Because they train for these things all the time.
Sure.
So I was like, I was with a great group of guys. It's fine. Like it's totally nonchalant. And then I'm like, uh-oh. Like keeps buzzing. And then my friend Carly, who at the time, bless her heart, was 8 months pregnant, calls me and she was like, what do you need? And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, Carly, but I need you to tell me right now because something's going on. Yeah. And she was like, you don't know? I'm like, no, I don't know. And she was like, okay, well, TJ's at the hospital. He was shot. I was like, is he okay?
Jeez.
I think so. And then I just got to like go into like, okay, what do I got to do? So my parents were downstairs. And of course I'm in my, like, you know, raggedy pajamas, like looking a mess. And I'm like, I bust into the room. I was like, TJ shot. I got to go. And they're like, what?
Yeah.
I was like, TJ was shot. He's on his way to BB. He's going to get flown out to Christiana. I got to go. And in the meantime, like, other people are calling me, friends, and I'm on my way. My dad drove me to the hospital, and from my house on the way to the hospital, that's when I got notified by the PD. It wasn't a very pretty phone call. There's lots of words in there that I can't say on here. I later apologized, but, you know, like I said, I think they did the best they could at the time. But at the time I was really angry that that's how I had to find out, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you have this expectation in your head that somebody's going to show up to your door and say, it's okay, we're going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, not that at all. So get to the hospital. They asked me for my ID, and I was like, what? I was like, my husband's back there. I need to get back there. And they're like, we need your ID, please.
Jeez.
So I had to like go back out to my car. I don't even remember if I must have had it. But then I think by that time, the police department was there, and they walked me back. And I was able to see him for just a moment before they flew him up to the next trauma hospital.
How long of a drive was that with your dad from your house to the hospital?
It felt like forever, but it was probably just 10 minutes, I would say, because it was at night and a weekday, and we live in a beach town, so it was off season, so it wasn't like super busy.
What were you thinking?
I remember saying, just let him be alive. Just let him be alive.
You had no idea how bad he was hurt?
No, nothing. So you know how news travels. So a friend of mine was like, I know he got shot in the face.
Oh my God.
Really?
So in my head, I was like, I had a friend who unfortunately her husband had been hit by a car and he had traumatic brain injury. I was like, you know what? We can do this. It's okay. You know, you start like playing these scenarios mm-hmm. in your head. And I was like, it's okay. You know, he doesn't have to have a pretty face anymore. We've been married long enough.
Yeah.
But that's what she was like. I know he got shot in the face, but that's all I know.
Ugh.
So in my head, I'm like, okay, well, there's damage. It's okay. And then when I got to the hospital, it was just like a patch over his face. So I couldn't see it. I didn't know his hands were broken. I knew he got shot in the leg. So there wasn't a lot of information. I know the doctor that I spoke to at the hospital in our town was like, he's in stable but critical condition. We have to list him in that condition to fly him. When they get to Christiana, they'll stabilize him more in ICU, and then he'll have surgery. So that's like all I knew, mm-hmm. really.
Wow.
And then you went 7 days and you couldn't see him?
Yeah. Yeah, it was in the height of COVID, and like, man.
Wow.
I know the woman's name that runs the hospital, I won't say it, but she has a strong willpower, strong ethos. You know, we had senators calling, we had representatives calling, we had, you know, the head of state police, we had everybody trying to get me in. Like, we were coming up with a plan to get me some 511s and a vest so I could walk in as a marshal to, like, jeez, slip me in.
That is terrible.
Yeah.
But they were following protocol, so I can't, you know, I understand. As much as I didn't like it or agree with it, I understand. And so luckily by the last day they said I could come in. I had to like show negative COVID testing. I had to show all these things, but
jeez,
but you got in,
but I got in. So that was great.
So
and I didn't have to fake myself as a police officer.
Yeah, that's wild. I actually kind of wish that would have happened.
I know that would have been a better story,
right?
Pulled
it off. Yeah. That would have been pretty epic, but, that is terrible. I think what COVID did to people, anybody that was in the hospital, like your condition, he's shot, he's your husband, but people that were having babies and like, I mean, that was terrible. That was that was an awful time for people. So before we break this, but what is something that you could offer somebody that could help them prepare for this, whether it's a wife, a spouse, from your perspective?
From my perspective, I will say I'm so thankful for the tribe that we had. You know, Delaware is a small community, and like TJ said, the law enforcement community is even smaller. But at the time, you also have to remember this was December 2020, not long after... it wasn't a great time to be a police spouse.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't a great
yeah.
time to be a police officer, yeah. right? The community I was fearful of how the community would react. We live in a relatively liberal area. Mm. The I don't say his name, but the person who was shot, he was a minority, so I was concerned about that.
Yeah.
Luckily, the police, they put people at my parents' house just to be protective of that. But we had an amazing group. We call them the six, like the other families that the three other gentlemen and their families that are part of the South team. Mm-hmm. Like find your tribe. You got to find the people that are going to be there to support you. And, you know, you have to come up with a plan because these things don't happen on your schedule, yeah. Right? Middle of the night, middle of the day.
Got kids you got to deal with, like you have life things.
Like who's going to get your kids from school if it happens in the middle of the day?
Yeah.
Who's going to sit with your kids in the middle of the night if you have to go out in the middle of the night? So you have to come up with a plan, and we didn't. You know, we were oblivious. I don't want to say oblivious, but it was just like, it's not going to happen to us. Happens to them.
Those are all really great points. I mean, those are things you just don't really think about as a cop because let's be honest, we always think it's not going to happen to us. So why prepare for that? So I think that's great advice. Anything from the police department's perspective? I mean, a lot of administrators from police agencies listen to this.
Yeah. I mean, where are your papers that say who they want contacted? Because if you're at home at 3 a.m. and those are in your office, how's that going to help you?
Yeah.
Like you need to have a plan and you need to have that information readily accessible.
Yeah.
Because news travels faster.
Well, with social media and exactly what happened to you, I mean, stuff gets on social media immediately.
God, that's a
so fast.
It's sad that people have to find out through social media. That's terrible. But departments need to know that though. They need to be ahead of it. They should be instantly thinking, okay, we know this is going to get on the media and it's going to get on social media within minutes. We got to go out and contact the family.
They have a plan. And yet, and I think that's a conversation that they have to have with their officers as well as what is your plan? Mm-hmm. What is your family's plan? We need to talk about this because God forbid it happens and you don't have a plan and then what? Right. So I think it has to be part of that. You have to have those forms readily accessible and it has to be a plan that you have with your officers, a discussion.
Yeah. Well, shoot, thanks for sharing your perspective. I mean, we've never had the opportunity to have a spouse of an officer that was involved in something like that here and got to hear their side of the story. So thanks for sharing that with us. I know you guys went through a really hard time. You definitely both came out on top. TJ, come over here.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. And thank you for sharing your story. There's a lot of times we talk in our classes that officers leave and they leave their loved ones at home, hoping everything's going to be okay, but not realizing that the ones that are left at home also have trauma and also thinking about stuff. Yeah. So for you to come on and share your side of a not great experience and then how you guys are two now sitting next to each other, I mean, this is a wild journey. For me, this is the first I've heard of it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we appreciate you guys coming on. And TJ, I mean, phenomenal story. I think, your best days are yet to come. I mean, you're on the road to something great.
I appreciate it, man.
And I'm glad that TAC Ops was able to have you out here and get to share your story to a lot of other cops. I think it's super important.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Appreciate TAC Ops having me out here. I came to this conference back in like 2014. It's cool, man. And yeah, appreciate you guys too, man. You were the first podcast I ever went on, man.
Yeah. Well, hey, we're happy. Yeah. We're glad we could accommodate that.
Scared and nervous. But we got it done, man. Now we're here and get to meet you guys. So it's been great, man. You guys are killing it, man. Good for you. I'm happy for you, man.
Yep. Same with you, man. Well, all right.
We'll go to thetjweb.com, order this book, follow you on social media at thetjweb, check them out.
And get signed up for a TAC Ops conference. Don't forget. All right, guys, that's it for today's episode. We will catch you on the next one.